The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This is Fred Brack, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service, and for the next half hour, I'll be reading to you from Our State magazine. Today's reading of Our State is underwritten by the Carter Glass Insurance Agency, serving the community since 1974 and underwriting our podcast for over 10 years. They can be reached at 919-781-1973. And now we are ready to return for the final time in the April 2021 edition of Our State Celebrating North Carolina. We're going to start this last reading of the month, as we always do, by reading the article from the decade of the particular year we're reading in. This year it's 1970s, the decade of disruption. Which is interesting because the term disruption has come into the financial community in the last year or so, and in this particular decade that we're in now, as disrupting industries that change our way of thinking about things. Well, anyway, let's see what happened back in the 1970s. There's a picture of a huge Galapagos tortoise on the side where the title begins, and on the full page spread on the right hand side, we see a black and white picture of some kids that are leaning against a fence, and they are looking at a giraffe and five zebras. Room to Roam is the title of the 1970s article this month. In Asheboro, the rolling Piedmont starts to look like a slice of Africa as a new state-supported zoo aims to teach the value of conservation and give its animals space to be themselves. Written, as always, by Philip Girard. By 1970, North Carolina seems to have it all: a state-run art museum, a first-class symphony, an impressive university and community college system, NASCAR and other big league sports, public television, a chain of pristine national seashores, and hundreds of square miles of breathtaking national forests connected by the Blue Ridge Parkway. What it doesn't have is a state zoo. During the previous decade, the Raleigh JCs set out to change this. They educated state legislators about the cultural and economic benefits that a zoo would bring to the state, convincing its North Carolina Zoological Study Commission of the merits of their argument. Then they sponsored an NFL exhibition game between the Washington Redskins and the New York Giants. 33,500 fans crowded into Carter Finley Stadium in Raleigh to watch the Redskins roll over the Giants 31-13. Ticket sales generated $40,000, twice the projected budget for a feasibility study. The legislators, newly formed NC Zoological Authority, assembles a 9-member team that includes some of the best people in the field. Whatever locale is selected must meet 14 stringent conditions. Among them, the site must cover at least 1,000 acres, and that the home community must pledge a minimum of $150,000 to the project. For more than 2 years, the site selection committee explores possible locations in Albemarle, Concord, Statesville, Butner, Chatham County, and Asheboro. One suitor is the North Carolina Zoological Society Incorporated, a coalition from Greensboro, Winston-Salem, and High Point, incorporated as a nonprofit in 1968. In 1971, the committee selects a wooded parcel of 1,005 acres that includes Purgatory Mountain in Randolph County, southeast of High Point near Asheboro. A new group is formed in Asheboro and assumes the North Carolina Zoological Society's name and mission. Its fundraising arm, headed by David Stedman, raises $435,000 in just 5 weeks to match the legislator's $2 million bond and another $2 million county bond for the necessary infrastructure at the site. The goal is to create an empathetic connection between visitors and the animals. The advisory group includes several visionaries in the field of zoo design and purpose. George Spidell, who oversaw planning for the new Milwaukee Zoo, Theodore H. Reed, a pioneer of conservation biology and breeding programs at the National Zoo in Washington, D.C., and William J. Hoff, who has held top positions at the Lincoln Park Zoo in Chicago, the Cincinnati Zoo, and the St. Louis Zoological Park. Hoff is selected to become the NC Zoo's founding director and master planner. One of his fellow founding fathers is Dwight Holland, who helped secure the Ashboro site and becomes its first curator of design. That's an ambitious undertaking with an equally ambitious goal, not just to protect wildlife, but also to create an empathetic connection between visitors and the animals, thus enlisting them in the mission of conservation of animals and their habitats in the wild. Creating a zoo is an expensive and complex undertaking with lots of moving parts, many of them alive and pursuing their own natural imperatives, which may or may not become compatible with the aim of a zoo. In the 19th century, American zoos were essentially jails. Animals were kept in secure, locked enclosures, often just small cages, to be viewed as entertaining objects of curiosity. Victorian-era zoos often enclosed animals in ornately beautiful reptile houses, monkey houses, and the like. In the early 20th century, zoos assumed the character of art museums and came under the sway of the modernist movement. Enclosures became canvases on which animals assumed their roles in parts of the composition, a scene. They featured faux terrain crafted from formed concrete, water features and moats, exhibits as living landscapes. Only in the mid-20th century did the welfare of animals become central to zoo design. Dr. Heini Hediger's 1942 book, Wild Animals in Captivity, quietly started a revolution in zoo philosophy and design. Hediger addressed such basic issues as the problem of confined space, exploring both the biology and the psychology of captive animals, including the technical challenges of building enclosures and questions about ethics, health, safety, territory, and the drive to escape or not, and the ecological niche occupied by the same species in the wild. Hoff and his associates envision a new kind of zoo, one that keeps animals inside habitats as much as like their natural homes as possible. It's a relatively new paradigm, physically, spatially, architecturally, philosophically, ethically, environmentally, even financially, as most zoos are not owned by states. Habitats will be arranged as zoo geographic clusters, starting with Africa. The enclosed territories will feature topography and plants to replicate the natural world. Barriers will be invisible so that the visitors forget that they're in a zoo and feel like they're entering the animals' habitats. The plan is called Alive, and with good reason. Thus, the presentation represents not a fixed construction blueprint, but reads the master plan, but a rather flexible guideline for the future, a guideline that will be continually updated in the light of new experience while constantly maintaining an honest concern for ecological integrity. The plan is actually alive. And it is as much ethically and social undertaking as a zoological one. The North Carolina Zoological Park intends to express the highest ideals of our society, diversity, freedom, compassion, and a respect for nature. The zoological park will be as concerned for the animals' welfare as for the visitors' pleasure. Creating a wild animal park would be daunting enough, but add people to the equation, and it becomes exponentially more difficult. You're trying to accomplish two apparently contradictory things at once, allowing the animals to live as naturally as possible without artificial disruption, and inviting a stream of visitors to observe them as intimately as safe design will allow, a completely unnatural situation. You have to protect the people from the animals every zoo professional's nightmare is to have somebody's child slip through a guardrail and be mauled by a lion, as happened at the National Zoo in 1958. You need to protect the animals from one another so that, say, a territorial male polar bear doesn't kill a cub. And animals unaccustomed to captivity need to be protected from injuring themselves in frenzied efforts to escape. Just as difficult, you have to protect the animals from people harassing them, even climbing into the enclosures to touch them. And because the whole point is to draw the maximum number of visitors, your very success magnifies the challenge. In addition to the costs of construction and acquiring the animals, feeding them, and providing veterinary services, expenses include salaries for the director and curators, keepers, maintenance crews, security personnel, education specialists, clerical support, and staff to interact with the crowds of visitors, from busloads of school children to vacationing tourists. While the ambitious plan of a habitat-centered zoo is still in the drawing board, an interim zoo takes shape on the site, a modular office and a welcome area. Then a sturdier office for the staff and a temporary chain-link fence paddocks. By 1973, the interim 21-acre zoo is ready to receive its first residents, a pair of giant Galapagos tortoises named Tort and Retort. Soon they have plenty of company, including otters, rhinos, slow lorises, gibbons, and even a tiger. Some 250 creatures in all. Two young arrivals, an African elephant named Cesar, and a chimpanzee named Hondo, quickly become favorites. Lieutenant Governor James B. Hunt dedicates the North Carolina Zoo in August 1974. Though still in its nascent stage, the zoo was an immediate hit, drawing thousands of visitors. 2 years later, workers break ground for the permanent habitat-centered zoo a half-mile down the road. By the end of the decade, the first African habitat opens, a mixed 4.5-acre landscape of forest and grasslands, punctuated by dry washes and natural-looking formations that mimic the regional granite-gray ridge rock and really function as invisible containment barriers for the grazing zebras and giraffes and the roaming ostriches. Other habitats soon follow, home to baboons, chimpanzees, elephants, and lions. It really helps with the animals' health and well-being to be able to give them as large a habitat as possible and places that they might be able to get relief from being right at the guest's view. Places to kind of hide behind, explains Krista McGee, who starts as a design intern under the mentorship of Dwight Holland and in time becomes director of facilities operations. But the trade-off for the visitor might be losing a continuous close-up of the animal. Mimsy Price, a writer from Chapel Hill, recalls, "I remember my parents taking my sister and me shortly after the new natural habitats debuted and being simultaneously amazed at the scale of it, and kind of mad that the elephants were so far away." Over the following decades, in fulfillment of its flexible long-range plan, the zoo expands into the world's largest area. By area, with 500 developed acres populated by 1,800 animals, including African and North American habitats, conservation, research, and captive breeding programs. It stands at the crossroads of what American zoos used to be and what they are now and must aspire to become, not just a menagerie of captive animals, but also a living habitat, truly alive. Coming next month, a governor and his lieutenant find common ground. If you want to visit the North Carolina Zoo, it's at Zoo Parkway. The actual number on Zoo Parkway really doesn't matter, does it? It's in Asheboro, nczoo.org. And now, cast in a new light, the French sculptor Auguste Rodin revolutionized his medium, capturing humanity instead of heroism. At the North Carolina Museum of Art, home to the large collection of his work, some of his bronze figures live in the outdoors, steadfast yet ever-changing with the elements. Written by Lisa Roberts. There's a page and a half view here of a pond, man-made pond, with lots of lilies on it. with three Rodin figures at the end, and another one off to the side. As the caption says, in the North Carolina Museum of Art's Iris and B. Gerald Cantor Court and Garden, Auguste Rodin's Meditation with Arms stands across a reflecting pool from the three shades. That would be the three figures that were there. Art outdoors is an art of a different sort. In the natural world, surrounded by trees and grasses, birds and bugs, weather and passersby's, such sculptures live their own lives. They don't hide away in hushed rooms waiting to be seen or require an audience to come alive. Instead, they offer themselves freely and without transaction, a bit of magic within the larger wonder of God's creation. In such a setting, to see art of true genius, of magnificence, is a rare kind of entrapment. Enchantment. The first time I experienced this was as a child growing up in Pasadena, California. Auguste Rodin's The Thinker sat outside our beloved Norton Simon Museum up high beside a twisted coral tree. Bent over, chin on fist, he thought with every muscle in his body as cars whizzed past, as Santa Ana winds brushed his skin, as the floats of our annual Rose Parade glided by. Perhaps he thought, how ephemeral their beauty. Rooted, sturdy, honest, visceral, he was the unmistakable creation of the French artist who was renowned as the founder of modern sculpture. Rodin was a renegade in his time, eschewing artifice, embracing the truth of what makes us human. I live in North Carolina now, and that's what I think of every time I see one particular self-contained beauty who stands along a path at the North Carolina Museum of Art in Raleigh. She is Rodin's naked muse without arms, study for the monument to Whistler. She is sorrowful and alone. She's not decorative. She's real. Thankfully, she's not without family. They are a short stroll away along a serpentine path to a place of peace-filling enrichment to rival any house of worship. Here in the Rodin Garden, a private but airy courtyard spliced into the museum's famed glass-walled building, sculptures of beauty and pathos surround a quietly trickling reflecting pool. Each is astonishing in its own way. To visit these works one by one and then to sit and take them all in, to feel their humanity within the gentle confinement of their outdoor room, to let the whoosh of traffic fade into white noise, to consider the genius of the sculpture and the stories of his subjects, to embrace the simplicity of bronze in his gravel, glass, and water, is to leave the world behind. Four of the remarkable 30 Rodins that represent one of the nation's most beautiful repositories of this master's work stand here. The rest are just inside the museum's doors, shepherded by NCMA's former director, Dr. Lawrence J. Wheeler. The Iris and B. Cantor, or B. Gerald Cantor Foundation, donated all of these works of art to our state museum in 2009. The first and largest of the outdoor sculptures, the Three Shades, anchors the space and sobers the visitor. Depicting the souls of the damned at the gates of hell as described in the Inferno of Dante Alighieri's Divine Comedy, the shades are three identical figures, united in grief, turned in on themselves, heads bowed low, shoulders aligned. Rodin carved them to stand atop his monumental 180-figure Gates of Hell, from which they would be seen from far below. Subsequently, they were cast as this independent, larger-than-life work to be appreciated face-to-face as the flawed but human beings they are. At the time Rodin sculptured these poor men, his peers chose very different subjects, preferring idealized depictions of the characters of myth and legend. Rodin preferred something rawer. Even his technique was turbulent. His modeling pocked, his subject emotions unvarnished. Take the noble Jean d'Auvergne clothed, steps away from the shades. In mid-stride, Defiance beseeches, arms outstretched. He is one of the six burghers of Calais who in 1347 offered themselves as hostages to King Edward III of England, the monarch who'd laid siege to their city during the Hundred Years' War. Defiance is clear-eyed but despairing, brave and sorrowful. A maquette of Rodin's entire celebrated monument to this man and his brethren, the burghers of Calais, is inside. On a recent visit, I went inside to see these tiny burghers and made the unexpected acquaintance of a knowledgeable security guard. He engaged me in a long conversation about Rodin's life and loves, his sculpting technique, and the casting process that creates the bronzes in the Rodin Gallery. He even handed me a slip of paper he'd prepared for interested visitors with a website that explains the ancient and complicated lost wax method. Rodin had clearly gotten to him, too. Back in the garden, another tragic figure from the artist's gates of hell stands nearby. Meditation with Arms depicts a young woman's twisting her body to shield it from a fate of damnation. Her vulnerability is painful to behold, her grace inarguable. And then along the pool's opposite side, a shift, a surprise. Two contemporary works of an entirely different sort leap into this mythic mix. Disembodied Bronze Wings by South African artist Wim Botha appear, full feathered in flight. Part of the Intercessions series created by the NCMA's director, Dr. Valerie Hillings, to juxtapose works from different eras and mediums to spark intriguing conversations. Botha's sharp, birdless wings soar on spiky scaffolds. Like their neighbors, they are made of bronze. Unlike them, they are not of this world, not human or burdened or tragically fated. Instead, they depict an abstraction, forward motion, possibility, the triumph of will. What else could make bronze wings soar? To their desolate fellows in the sanctuary, these wings offered salvation. And then finally, one more Rodin, the Asia Minor mother goddess, Sibyl. Substantial in scale, reclining, grounded, headless, she is a universal female form with power to spare. A celestial body of earthly proportions facing the shades. Her maternal presence underlines the promise of both his wings and offers something gentler, forgiveness, acceptance, a lap to lie in. Several empty, rounded plinths stand nearby, dotted around the pool and among the sculptures. When my children are small, they leap on these platforms to strike statuary poses. At quieter moments, visitors find them welcome spots for contemplation, a pause before exploring the 164-acre museum park and its more than 30 additional outdoor sculptures, like Thomas Sayer's Gyre and Wallace Simpson's Wind Machine. Some of the park's sculptures look so at home in the land, so heartwarming and familiar, as if they bloomed in place, like Henry Spencer Moore's Knife Edge and Large Spindle Piece. And there are more, none perhaps to rival the Rodin's, but extraordinary, varied, and very much worth meeting. Make their acquaintance, and you'll see. Our masterworks are in great company. North Carolina Museum of Art, 2110 Blue Ridge Road, tons of parking. ncartmuseum.org. I think there's a sidebar in here. It says, visit Rodin's bronzes, then check out Ogromna, Ursula von Reidensvard. Commissioned for the opening of the Thomas Pfeiffer-designed West Building in 2010, Ursula von Reidensvard, Ogromna, shown above in the picture, is the Rodin's nearest neighbor, a craggy tower of honeycombed cedar of more than 20 feet tall that appears to have spun itself out of the earth's core to get a better look. And that's what it looks like. It looks like a whole bunch of trees. Tree trunks all come to a common center, and they fan out like a comb. I've been to the museum a number of times. I have never noticed that. It's definitely worth going to observe. It's outside. Union 060719, Hoss Haley. The latest addition to the NCMA's Ann and Jim Goodnight Museum Park. Hoss Haley's Union 060719 stands on a rise at the entrance. A proud and welcoming sentry, Haley created its lithe curbs and linear heft out of cork and steel in his spruce pine studio in 2019. Askew, Roxy Payne. The stainless steel tree that greets all comers with its twisting branches isn't really a tree at all, says its maker, Roxy Payne. It's a dendroid, inspired by trees, but not meant to replicate one. A viewer can spot other likely influences, the connectedness of living things, the beauty of the irregular, the tensile strength of the rooted. Installation 1-183, Daniel Johnson. The 183 individual wood-fired ceramic pillars that form a row across the gentle hill of the park landscape are the work of Seagrove artist Daniel Johnson. Made of native clay, they range in size from a few inches to more than 6 feet tall, together evoking an organic border, fence, or outcropping. And finally, Lowe's Pavilion, Mike Sindrick and Vincent Petrarca. This subtly gorgeous art-as-shelter structure offers an unexpected and light-dappled respite from the sun or the rain. It also frames a striking view of Yinka Schoenaber's colorful wind sculpture, too, as it waves against the acres of treetops that make this magnificent park such a welcome sanctuary. And we just have a few minutes left here, or actually just about 1 minute. I'm going to tell you about the picture at the front in the section called View From Here. There's just one picture each month. It's a double spread. Clearly, these are fishermen on the shore of an ocean area. And it says, cast a line in Buxton. The sun may be going to sleep, but these fishermen at Cape Point sure aren't. By the dwindling light of the sun's rosy orange rays, the men wade into the surf with anticipation, hoping for a heart-thumping tug in their lines. Maybe they'll catch a Spanish mackerel or a mullet. But from April to November, the real stars of the sea, at Cape Point at least, are the red drum. Each spring, experienced anglers congregate at this Hatteras Island spot to take part in the drum run. Catching this copper-hued fish is the grand finale to a long day on the beach. Beautiful blue sky getting lighter and lighter as it gets to the horizon, which is an orange and yellow and purple right at the edge of the water. The waves are cresting a little bit. The men are pulling back on their lines. They all have these long poles, maybe 2 to 3 times as tall as they are, standing together in a line. That, my friends, is all the time we have for today's episode of our State Magazine. Hope you enjoyed it. You'll join us next time. I'm Fred Brack, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Today's reading of our State Magazine was underwritten by, of course, the Carter Glass Insurance Company, serving the community since 1974. The contents of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Our State Magazine is readily available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org, and on iTunes. If you have any comments or questions, call us, please, 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.